Well, there was loads on the radio, and as Tammy Wynette once sang, sometimes it's hard to be a woman. What do you mean sometimes? We're back to those heartbreaking stories of the menopause. Also, the cyber attacks on our health system and Michael Mosley on improving your health. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
It's a business meeting in a very cold room with all men usually, and you feel like there's flames coming out of your head and maybe your upper lip is dripping with sweat. It's no fun.
We're about promoting rural Ireland, and I do feel today that rural Ireland were left on the back bench.
We all know that cybercrime exists. We've all heard of, you know, such attacks on institutions before, but you'd have to be a pretty low form of human being, wouldn't you, to attack maternity hospitals' computer records?
And let's start here. It dominated the Liveline for the past 8 days. Women getting on the phone, the email and the voice messages to share their stories about the menopause.
I am of that generation where girls were reared with the concept that all the suffering that is entailed in just being a woman was something you just had to put up with. All my life I experienced unbearably painful periods. I worked all my life and believe no mercy was shown, even when on a number of occasions I passed out at work due to pain, then given about 10 minutes or so to come around and then back to work. I had difficult enough pregnancies and long painful induced labours. When perimenopause arrived, I looked forward to the day of no more periods. Perimenopause was difficult enough. Heavy bleeds could come at any time. Cycles were all over the place. I wore long dark pants to work all the time, as without warning, bleeding would start. I found myself dealing with a customer on more than one occasion and feeling the blood flowing down my legs into my socks. And I had to just continue with work, waiting for a chance to get to a bathroom to try and freshen up as best I could. When bleeds finally stopped and menopause proper took over, the hot flushes were unbearable. Every 20 minutes or so, my head and face would literally boil up, and then the dripping sweat would start to pour down my face, chest and back. But the worst part of these for me was the feeling of weakness and thinking I would faint. The hot flushes are less intense now, but still occur a few times daily. Sleep is almost an alien concept now for me. I have not had a full night's sleep in 11 years. If I get 3 hours without waking, that's a good night. I am constantly in pain, especially in the mornings. Feet, knees, hips, back, shoulders, neck, arms. The pain eases as the day goes on, and I never associated this pain with menopause until listening to your show. I just put it down to getting older, and I'm only 59. The point of my long-winded message is that most of my life, the quality of my life, has been hampered by all that goes with just being a woman. And as I said, we were told by our mothers before us that it is the lot of women. Thanks again, Liveline. Now we know there is so much that can be done if we can find the right doctors and if employers could just cut us a little bit of slack.
Hi, Joe. I just want to say and advise, encourage women to keep going for help if they think they're in the menopause. It took me a long 9 years to get help, and at that point my life was going down the pan. Doors have been closed to me by GPs. I've been asked if I wanted to kill myself, my two children outside the room. I couldn't understand that I knew what was wrong with me, but I couldn't get anyone to help. It's not good enough to say to women, it's probably the menopause. Get on with it. It's not good enough to say to women, I think you're having a psychiatric breakdown. I wasn't having a psychiatric breakdown. I was completely at the end of my tether with menopausal symptoms. I didn't need antidepressants. I needed HRT. And if there's even one woman, just one, that heard this message, if you can keep getting the fight to look and to insist there's something that can be done to help you, then it's worth it. It's worth it for you. It's worth it for your children. It's worth it for your marriage, your relationships. But you deserve to have a life after the menopause.
Hi Joe, it's Paula here. I'm 52 and single, and I'm guardian to my now 18-year-old niece, whose mum, my dearest sister Nuala, died in November 2018 of ovarian cancer. In June last year, I was diagnosed with estrogen receptive breast cancer and had injections, lumpectomy, and radiotherapy sessions, 20 sessions. I'm on estrogen blockers now for another 4 years. So I can't take the HRT. When I was 45, 46, the menopause started, and at 47, I found I couldn't function well. The hot flashes, the night sweats, they were the worst of it. And I was working, I was in business meetings in a very cold room with all men usually. And you feel like there's flames coming out of your head, and maybe your upper lip is dripping with sweat. It's no fun. Also having to get off public transport, the Lewis at the bus to rip off your coat or jumper in the middle of December isn't great either, causing you to be late, etc. Because my cancer is such a hormone receptor positive, I can't go back on HRT. I went on HRT when I was 47, and it was like all the other women are talking about, it was life changing. I had no real qualms about going on it, and I was just so grateful to my GP for prescribing it. But now I suppose my oncologist is very reluctant, and I suppose my sister's history as well. So it is pretty risky for me to go on. So I just have to figure it out. I'm very fit cardiovascularly. I spin, I cycle, I do mindfulness, I do yoga every day, but now my body is too sore to even do yoga in the mornings. I sweat all night. I have multiple fans, cold cloths, everything at night. When people look at me, meet me, they think I look great and I'm in good form, but behind the scenes, it's very different. It's awful. Trying to explain to people all the multitude of things that are going on, and you just know that people don't understand, and they kind of get sick of hearing you feel as if you're being negative all the time. Thank you so much for all of the stuff that you've done on this in the last week, and for all your listeners who've called in and texted and written in and everything. It's just great to hear it being talked about.
Hello, Joe. I'm just making this recording and sending it in to you just about your programs over the last week. I'm really grateful that this subject has come and that so many that we're all talking about it. It's been a lonely place. I started the perimenopause at 47. I'm now 52. I took HRT for 3 months and then had a fibroid in my breast, and my GP refused to give me HRT after that. So I've been managing up to now, and particularly during the lockdown last year, everything for all those other women that spoke, you know, the tinnitus, the night sweats, the hot flushes. Genuinely, I thought I was losing my mind, but I made an appointment with my GP, and I'm going next Thursday, and there you go. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
Just some of the voices of women on the live line in the afternoon. And in the morning, we were waking up to a major cyber attack on our health service. Here's Anya Lawler.
Morning Ireland at 13 minutes past seven. And just as we came on air, the Rotunda Maternity Hospital issued a statement saying they're experiencing a major ransomware cyber attack, which is affecting all of the hospital's electronic systems and records. Staff at the hospital are working to resolve the issue. All appointments have been cancelled for today, Friday, the 14th of May. The only exception is for patients who are 36 weeks or more pregnant, and otherwise, clients are asked not to attend the Rotunda unless it's an emergency. The master of the Rotunda Hospital, Fergal Malone, is on the line. Fergal Malone, good morning, and tell us how this evolved.
Good morning, Anya. We discovered during the night that we were the victim of what's called a Conti ransomware attack. This has, we also believe, affected other hospitals. And it basically means that we've had to shut down all of our computer systems. Now, thankfully, we have contingency plans in place for this, that the hospital can function absolutely normally using a paper-based system. But obviously, throughput will be much slower. So all patients in the hospital are safe, all the care is being provided, there's no problems for patient safety. But as a precaution, we're asking all patients who have appointments at the Rotunda today to not attend the hospital unless it's an emergency or unless they're 36 weeks pregnant or over.
The machinery and equipment, the life-saving machinery and equipment that you would have in the delivery suites and the premature baby units, are they all okay?
Yes, all equipment such as that are all absolutely operational and fine. It's computers logging into electronic healthcare records that is the issue, and the ability to access patient demographics, things like that, computer-based systems. They've all been taken offline as a precaution. But we have systems in place to revert back to what you might call old-fashioned paper-based record keeping. But as you can imagine, when a new patient arrives at the front door of the hospital, traditionally you type in her name into a computer and get all of her details. That can't happen now, so we have to do that by hand and paper. So throughput as patients come through the front door will be much slower than normal.
I'm just seeing a statement just in from the HSE, Fergal Malone. The HSE says there has been a significant ransomware attack on the HSE IT systems. They have taken the precaution of shutting down all of their IT systems in order to protect them from this attack and to allow the HSE to fully assess the situation with their security partners. The HSE apologises for the inconvenience to patients and to the public and will give further information as it becomes available, and we'll be bringing that to you throughout the programme. But that would suggest a really widespread attack is going on here, Fergal Malone, would it?
Yeah, it would certainly seem to be. We use a very common system throughout the HSE for registering patients and getting their demographics, and it is certainly seems as if that may have been the entry point or source, because if you start seeing this in other hospitals, that is the more likely explanation. Four major maternity hospitals in Ireland are already fully electronic: ourselves, National Maternity Hospital, Cork University Maternity Hospital and Kerry. So we all use the same electronic system. But beyond that, it's a hospital registration system that is common across most hospitals in Ireland. And it seems to therefore be affecting those hospitals as well.
I mean, we all know that cybercrime exists. We've all heard of, you know, such attacks on institutions before. But you'd have to be a pretty low form of human being, wouldn't you, to attack maternity hospitals' computer records?
Well, obviously, at the moment, we're putting all of our focus on keeping operations going and keeping everybody safe, which, of course, everybody is safe and services are proceeding. But we will leave it to the other authorities to pursue, once this is all resolved and we're back operational, to pursue how this happened and who the potential, where it originated from.
Fergal Malone, Master of the Rotunda Maternity Hospital, talking to Anya Lawler in the morning. And later, how prevalent are cyber attacks like the HSE one? Simon Woodworth, lecturer in Business Information and Systems at University College Cork, spoke to Brian Dobson on the News at One.
A very good afternoon to you, Dr. Woodward. Thanks for taking our call. I know that we spoke to you towards the end of last year on this programme in relation to some concerns you had about the HSE's cyber security protections. What do you make of what we know so far about this attack, which, it has to be said, is fairly little at this point?
Good afternoon, Brian. Well, until Anne O'Connor came on to the programme, I would have assumed that this was related perhaps not to to systems not necessarily being up as up-to-date as they should. However, she's characterised this as a zero-day exploit, which means it's a brand new variant of an existing ransomware, which means even if you had everything up-to-date and if you had all your antivirus software up-to-date on a daily basis, it's very difficult to defend against something like this. And Conti ransomware is particularly toxic. Listening to what Anne and Oisin have been saying, the HSE is doing absolutely everything correctly here to contain and neutralise the ransomware. But the problem is that Conti is very, very clever at hiding itself in computer memory and also hiding its internal structure and hiding where it came from, which is going to make investigation particularly difficult. But notwithstanding my previous comments about Windows 7 and getting up to date, I would have to say that the HSE has done everything right in trying to handle this.
Just to give us some sense of how long this might have been in preparation, how long before the attack was launched overnight, the systems had been infiltrated. How long was this in the making?
Well, Conti itself has been around since May of last year. But for this particular attack, Conti is unlike earlier ransomwares in that it's human controlled. So previous ones like WannaCry or Petya can actually be, if you like, they're fire and forget almost types of ransomware where you unleash the payload and you walk away from it. But in this case, Conti is managed by a team of hackers. So it's not at all surprising to hear that there might have been odd things going on in HSE's network yesterday, because they may have been looking for weak points in the system where they could insert the ransomware. And then even once the ransomware is on board, they would be looking to manage its progress through the network. And they could also be using their access to the network to extract data to find out about logins, or it really depends on their motives.
Would you expect that there would be at some point some kind of a ransom demand or a threat to release information?
Well, the economic justification for ransomware is that you do make a ransom demand, because basically saying we won't encrypt your data unless you pay us money. That's the economic basis for doing this. For instance, the pipeline ransomware attack in the United States, the Colonial Pipeline attack, they paid $5 million in ransom very quickly to actually free up their systems again. But some of the ransomwares, and Conti's included in this, include a double threat of saying, not only will we encrypt your data, but we will publish your data up on a server for everybody to see.
Simon Woodworth on the News at One with Brian Dobson. Now, so many people are getting their lives back now that they're vaccinated. Have a listen to Mo Austin's mail from the Ryan Tipperty Show.
Nana, also known as Mo Austin, was on to say, we had a magic moment today. Our daughter texted to see if Sam, her 10-year-old, could walk over to us from school as she had a meeting. He used to walk over. I'd collect him every Tuesday from Kill of the Grange School before the pandemic. Tuesday was his choice, as Monday was unpredictable, in his words, as Gramps had his cardiac exercises and Nana might have to take him there. So the magic moment came today. Gramps opened the door, got a hug, and then he ran down the hall, and I got the biggest hug that I've ever had in my life. All I could see when I was released was a huge pair of brown eyes looking up at me and a smile as big as himself. COVID robbed me of this little man for a year, but thankfully not our lives. After he had his usual crackers with butter and 7-Up, followed by his customary bar of chocolate, we got his little bits of gossip and life was just about back to normal. Regards, Nana, alias Mo Austin. Isn't that a lovely snapshot of a reunion?
From the Ryan Tipperty Show. And in the afternoon, Dr. Michael Mosley was talking about making those little changes for long-term health with Ray Darcy.
We've spoken to Dr. Michael Mosley on the show a few times in the past, most recently about the phenomenon of intermittent fasting. He has a new podcast out called Just One Thing. It's a wonderfully produced, short, bite-sized podcast. And in each one, Michael picks something, a little thing, that can greatly improve our health. And Michael's on the line now. How are you doing, Michael?
Very good, thanks. I'm actually talking to you from a wood at the moment. So I'm surrounded. You may be able to hear birdsong in the background.
I love birdsong. That's one of the things. Yes.
That's one of the things. Spend time in green spaces. I'm in bright green, surrounded by trees and an awful lot of birds at the moment.
And what's the science behind that?
Well, there is actually quite a lot. The Japanese are very fond of it. They call it forest bathing. And one of the advantages of spending time in green spaces, It has quite an effect on depression, anxiety. You get close to nature and the trees themselves actually produce this a sort of aromatic substance, which for some reason our brains really love and has been shown to boost our T cells, part of our immune system. Uh-huh. So you're actually, when you're breathing in that scent of trees, you're also breathing in things which seem to stimulate your immune system. So going back to our sort of roots, if you like, to our ancient times.
Okay, you do a full podcast on balancing. I was saying that to Pauline MacLynn, Mrs. Doyle from Father Ted, that you were coming on. And it's a thing that we lose as we get older, but it's a thing that we should try to hold on to.
Absolutely, because surprisingly enough, falls are the second commonest cause of accidental death after traffic accidents worldwide. And our ability to stand upright, which is pretty remarkable, there are very few other mammals that can do it. We do it without thinking, but that tends to fall off. And there is evidence that as the generations go by, people are getting worse at balancing because they're practicing less. They spend less time on their feet, more time sitting in their bottoms, looking at screens. And we, when you actually think of it, balancing is a pretty tricky thing, because when you're standing there, there are basically three sense organs keeping you upright. There's information coming from your feet, there's the inner ear, your balance organ there, and then there's your eyes. And your brain has to coordinate all three of them. And when it doesn't do that too well, that's kind of when you fell over. When you fall over, and as I said, as you get older, that is a problem. And so you can work on your balance. We all know about, you know, the importance of doing aerobic exercise, running, walking, things like that. Also strength exercises, press up squats. But very few people know that they should also be trying to work on their balance.
It's interesting because we had Professor Moyna on earlier in the year, and he'd put together a little sort of fitness test, and part of it was to stand on one foot and close your eyes. And he said to me, as a man of 56, that I should do about 11-12 seconds, and at the time he sort of ambushed me a bit, and I was live on air and all that sort of thing. But anyway, it scared me how difficult it was to do, and I thought I was a
absolutely
fit man.
I think he was a bit optimistic. In my experience, very few people over the age of 45 can do more than 7 or 8 seconds.
With their eyes closed, right. Okay.
If you'd been able to do it in 10 seconds, you'd have been doing well. With both eyes open, you should manage about 30 seconds on one leg. But with your eyes closed, you'd be lucky to do 10 seconds.
Okay.
And he probably told you that actually this is one of the best ways of predicting healthy life expectancy.
He did, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yes.
And it's a crucial skill, and one you can improve. One of the things I do, for example, is when I'm brushing my tooth in the evening, I stand on one leg and then the other leg while I'm brushing my teeth, and my balance has got better. You can also do the classic, you know, the one where you're drunk and you have to walk with your heel to your toe and do that forwards and then backwards. And that also is a good way of improving your balance. And it does lots of brilliant things, improves the tone, the way you walk, how you hold yourself. And as I said, it also seems to have quite a big effect on the brain as well.
Yeah, the great thing about it is, because I'm a bit competitive, I got a bit scared, and I said, I'm going to fix this. As you know, we're men as well, we want to fix things, I'm going to fix it. So every morning what I do now is I stand on one each leg separately and close my eyes, and the time I can do it now has increased over the last 3 or 4 months.
Impressive. What are you up to now then?
I don't want to say, but it's healthy. Let's say it's healthy, you know.
Absolutely. One of the things I do in the series is I get a member of the public to try the one thing. I do it myself, and then I interview an expert to see, you know, what's the science behind it.
Yes.
And the physiologist, the exercise physiologist who I was talking to, she had got herself up from 7 seconds to about 50 seconds
right
over a period of time.
Michael Mosley on The Ray Darcy Show. And back to the live line, and Joe played some audio of Dr. Deirdre Lundy debunking some of the myths around the menopause.
There are a lot of strange things said and talked about with regard to HRT, and some of them are completely ridiculous. So myth number one, HRT will give you breast cancer. That is absolutely not true. HRT will not take healthy breast tissue and turn it into cancerous breast tissue. It is not breast tissue. It is not oncogenic. It doesn't work like that. But if you are unfortunate enough to be one of the few women for whom breast cancer is in the future, and sadly 23 out of 1,000 of us between 50 and 60, that is our risk, HRT can sometimes promote the development of those cells. So the cells didn't originate because of the hormones, but they might grow a little faster in the presence of the hormones. Funny enough, they tend to be diagnosed quicker as a result of that. And a few studies have shown that the chances of dying from breast cancer are actually lower when your breast cancer is diagnosed while you're taking HRT. Another really frustrating myth that is doing the rounds for the last 30 years is that you need to have your periods finished before menopause can start, and that is absolutely not true. And that's where the sort of we've coined the term perimenopause. So menopause is a Greek word. It means the last day of the last period a woman will ever get. And it generally happens around 50, 52. But the symptoms of the beginning of the change, which is the perimenopause, can start 5 to 10 years before your last period. It's not uncommon for women to come into our surgery and still be getting very regular menstrual cycles with classic menopause symptoms. And just because you're still bleeding, even sporadically, doesn't mean you can't be in the menopause. It's even more difficult for you because you could still get pregnant. So sometimes HRT can promote your fertility. So even more important that you use both contraception and HRT. I've often heard it said that why would you bother with HRT? All it does is give you relief now. Sure, inevitably you'll have to come off of it, and when you do, your symptoms will be as bad as they ever were. And that is entirely not true. The process of the menopause takes about 10 to 12 years. And basically what happens is the hormones that are produced by the ovaries initially start to become sporadic in their release, and then they gradually decline. So by the time you're in your middle 60s, you have less estrogen in your blood than a teenage boy. So that's a very hard journey to make. And what happens with HRT is we don't put huge volumes of hormone into your blood. We just kind of supplement them so that there's not too many jumps. And then what we do is over the years, we gradually reduce the dose so that if you do decide to come off HRT, and you don't have to, but say you want to, and you do it nice and gradually over, say, the course of 3 months, 4 months, you should not get a bounce back, a rebound of your symptoms.
Dr. Deirdre Lundy on the Live Line with Joe Duffy. The salad days of summer, and Chef Brian McDermott was telling Claire Byrne how to cook for the promise of warmer days.
Now, a couple of months ago, wouldn't have thanked you for a cold salad, even if you'd made it, Brian. But you see, the days get longer, a little bit of heat, and we think, I'd want to move away from the roast dinners, as I was saying there, onto some lighter fare. We're all in that place now.
Yeah, definitely. And it's almost like May for me kind of brings in when, do you put away the winter coat or do you not? And it's the same with food. You're transitioning across, and then you wake up tomorrow morning and you think, God, it's bloody cold again. You know, are we back to something sort of hotter? But it will start to change. We will start to see that lightness. And that brings about a positivity and a mood about us and a vibrancy with the stretch in the evenings. And that can factor down in, Claire, to how we eat as well. But I think it's still important that we have flavour, because we need to enjoy our food. If you enjoy your food, you'll eat the right amount of it. If you eat the right amount of it, you'll feel a lot better within yourself. And of course, we're walking more, we're getting out more. So we can afford to eat a little bit more, and we can allow that just to be burned off. But simple things like burning, you know, or like bringing the flavours together, they don't change, because food is about layers. Simple things, if we're going to go a light soup. I mean, I have a recipe here today for a red lentil soup. You know, they're in the store cupboard. They've been hibernating all winter. Get them out, they're red, soak them in water. And then to start the sweating process, that's a key word. Things like onion and garlic, don't ever underestimate the importance of sweating that and a little bit of Irish rapeseed oil. They develop that layer of flavour at the base and the bottom. And then, of course, if you add something like smoked bacon, or I suppose I'm saying here today, lardons, you know, or pancetta, and being a little bit posh, but literally smoked bacon will do you.
Chopped up rasher, Brian, I think that's what you mean.
Basically, or if you've got one left over from the weekend, the day before, from the fry up, chop it up, put it in, it'll release the salt, it'll release the sweetness, the beautiful smoked flavour. They're all flavours that hang in your tongue, but they need heat to bring them out further. But those simple 3 to 4 ingredients is a great base, and then bring in your carrots for sweetness. Beautiful.
On the lentil front, you mentioned soaking them. Now, if I was throwing those into a stew, I would just throw them in, or I didn't really think that much about soaking them. When do you need to soak them and why?
About 15 or 20 minutes before you start the cooking process, for a couple of reasons. It wakes them up. You know, they've been in the dark of your cupboard, and because they are, you know, a cereal and a grain, what you want to do, cold water, just slowly let the water absorb in. That actually, in turn, Claire, speeds up the cooking. So you're not waiting, you're just tasting your soup or your stew and going, my God, they're still a little bit bitty. So it cuts the cooking time down by about half, which is what I love about it. And for a quick soup, you don't want a soup that's going to take 4 hours. Soup needs to be quick. You want more time outside, less time in the kitchen, soup bubbling away. And, you know, we're topping that up with a good fresh stock, seasoning it with a couple of herbs and a little bit of tomato if you wish, and then into a blender for this beautiful, smooth, summery soup. And how I finish that one off, Claire, is I hold back a little bit of bacon that's nice and crispy. put it on the top with a little drizzle of the rapeseed oil. Then you're going into sort of, am I chefy? No, absolutely not. At home, you deserve to do that for the 10 seconds that it takes. And, you know, the reward you get from family that say, oh my God, that is amazing. And it tastes good, full of goodness and full of the nutrition. And you'll be sitting in a bowl, outside or inside. You decide based on the weather, you'll love it.
Are you happy for us to use tinned lentils ever?
Oh, Claire, I heard you a couple of weeks ago and I says, now Claire's doing a bit of cheating at home there. And the next time I see her now, she might get a rap in the knuckles for that. So you've just walked straight into it.
Okay, go on. I can take it. It's Friday.
No, and of course you can with the likes of lentils and, you know, any of the kind of chickpeas and things like that. They're total convenience. They're perfectly fine in a tin. When it comes to a pasta sauce, now I may argue different in relation to making that. I think
we were talking to Agnes Boucher-Hayes about convenience foods and shortcuts.
Yeah.
And the pasta sauce was the one that got to you, was it?
It was a little bit. I was driving along the Wild Atlantic Way coast here and I actually pulled in. I thought, my God, can I say this publicly? And I won't. And here I am now going, Claire, that was my exact reaction.
If we caused you to pull in off the road, Brian, you're going to have to say it now that you have the chance. Go for it.
Yeah, well, the argument I was going to put forward is, come on here. We're talking here about, you know, a tomato-based sauce that you're going to put together by exactly what I said, sweating off in Irish rapeseed oil, a little bit of onion, a little bit of garlic, some oregano in the form of herbs, and then go for your tinned tomatoes, which is very consistent because we don't grow tomatoes all year round in Ireland. Sweat that off, a little bit of stock, let it simmer, season it up, and you have the most perfect, beautiful, in about 12 to 15 minutes, pasta sauce that has very little salt in it, no additives, no preserves, and you know what, Claire, put that into meatballs or just into some pasta that's cooked in the same time alongside it. In 15 minutes, you'll be sitting with that, dribbling over your knee in a bowl, going, God, I'm glad I did that.
Brian, you're not going to get an argument here because I agree with you, and it's as quick, you know, it's as quick.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, he wasn't having that, was he? That's Brian McDermott with Claire in the Morning. And from Oliver Callan, the Middle Isle gets a kick.
Meet the Kennedy family from Carrigaline shopping in their local Lidl.
We save a fortune on our groceries now and we blow on all the expensive stuff we find in the Middle Isle.
We have everything you need in Lidl, from baby food to barbecues, from disposable chainsaws to COVID-19 antigen tests.
We didn't realise you could buy medical supplies in Lidl. I'm hoping they have antibiotics next month and then we can dodge the doctor altogether.
Loads of families are making the switch.
We're the ministers and we made the switch to Lidl. Hey!
So as Minister for Health, I'm delighted that Lidl has antigen tests. I'm told there's limited availability to start, but they're going to ramp up supply, and by June 31st, everyone should have been offered at least one antigen test.
But even at Lidl, it's impossible to keep everyone happy, like the Neffet family.
We're the Neffets, and we'll never switch to Lidl.
If I wanted to buy snake oil, I'd go to the snake shop. These tests are a public menace, and the citizenry/egotry of Ireland cannot be trusted with them, just like they can't be trusted with public toilets, bins and benches.
Irish people are too thick to swab themselves correctly. Pretty soon they'd be putting carrots up their noses and wanting to become civil servants on six-figure salaries as well.
At Lidl, we know these antigen tests could be the key to you having a decent summer. Why not ask Professor Luke O'Neill?
Yeah, well, you know, the lads are going gangbusters with the pandemic products, and I for one am delighted because it means that I wasn't talking through my hoop when I said the beer gardens will be open by June. Gangbusters!
And don't miss our special offer next month, scuba diving gear and a dialysis machine at half price. More to Lidl.
From Callan's Kicks. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Pauline McGlynn, Aga Wan Ga Wan, was having a bit of a catch-up.
The wonderful Pauline McGlynn joined us in studio.
What's left of her? What's left of her after this year we've had? There's more of me.
A virtual hug, since we're talking about hugs.
I'll take that, thanks. I'll give you an elbow in return, but I'm not allowed to spit at you anymore. Do you know, some things we'll miss.
are you not vaccinated?
I'm half vaccinated, right. Yeah. I'm half AstraZeneca'd. I don't know if you've found this, but, you've only just got your appointment.
No,
for Sunday. But there's a lot of snobbery in the vaccination world, or a lot of one-upmanship. You know, like my sister-in-law got the Pfizer and we all went, ooh, you know what I mean? And she only needs to wait 4 weeks for her second jab.
Yes.
My brother got the Moderna and they're now assuring me that I've only been just injected with water, you know, because they're poo-pooing the AstraZeneca. Yeah. But I'm very glad to have it. Yeah. And, you know, I got quite
given
emotional.
Given the choice, which would you have picked?
I suppose just because it sounds great. Or, you know, it's just literally the sound of it. The Pfizer. Because it's foxy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was happy when they said to me, it's AstraZeneca. I said, thank you very much, you know.
I'll take two.
Yeah. I've won now and I'll have won a while. I won't take them all at once, you know. Yeah. Too much pleasure. But I got quite emotional because, you know, I was queuing with a whole load of people my age and we were all there, you know, just shuffling in, presenting ourselves and saying that we were still alive and happy to be there. And I asked the nurse who gave it to me, you know, like, did she find a lot of people getting a bit tearful? And she said, yeah, but it's because it's hope, isn't it? You know, and I think that's it, isn't
so
it? It's just
tears
wonderful.
Of joy.
That's it, yeah, and the hope that it will
Did you have
help.
To give a lot of consideration to what you wore? Going to get your.
Do you know, it never even occurred to me. As long as you have the mask on, you know, you think, oh,
no,
I'm
but
grand.
Access to the upper arm. You
oh,
know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's. I think you're an idiot if you don't think that. Or else a show off who just needs to get naked in front of people. And in fairness, it's been a long time since we were allowed to do that as well, isn't it? Lockdown's put a stop to so many things. The simple pleasures. But it was wonderful. Yeah.
Now it looks like you're going to be an international vaccine recipient in that you got half vaccined in the UK.
Yeah, I had one of those lockdowns where, like everyone in showbiz, there was nothing. You know, like I was unemployed. But that's kind of the story of people in showbiz lives, unless they're Judi Dench. But even she was unemployed for the pandemic and shut down and locked down and the whole lot. So there was one little television job that was postponed for 316 days before we got to do it. And while we were doing it, because it was back in the UK, so I travelled over and, you know, did all my quarantines and tested out the yin yang and the whole lot. And while I was there and all of the travel restrictions started tightening and I was doing the little bit of work and thrilled with myself. And it was only a few days, but look at after a year of nothing, it was marvellous. And I got a letter from the NHS offering me my jab. And I thought, thank you very much. And I'm a great fan of the NHS. So I've taken my AstraZeneca from the UK.
Right.
Now, here's the thing. I'm due my second jab, but of course, you know, pretty much locked down here. And it's supposed to be in a few weeks' time. So I'm wondering, you know, I didn't even register with the HSE. Say I did, and I went in, and they gave me an AstraZeneca. That'd be me.
Kind of hands across
the border,
yeah.
Wouldn't it? But then again, you know, I'd look like I was only half vaccinated either here or there. So I don't know how that works.
My understanding is that the first and the second, they're the same.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
But you know what I mean?
There isn't a big stash of firsts and a big stash of seconds.
No, I'm sure they're the same. Yeah. But I'd have to have little notifications from both governments. Having said that, wouldn't that be in these post-Brexit days? Wouldn't it be lovely?
Yes.
Hands across
You'd
the sea.
You'd be an example.
And, do you know, and saying we can make things work.
Pauline McGlynn on The Ray Darcy Show. And in the morning, breaking news from the National Ploughing Association.
So news in the last few minutes about the Ploughing Championships. The National Ploughing Association has cancelled the trade exhibition and the World Ploughing Contest, but the ploughing competition, the national competition, will go ahead in September. Anna Marie McHugh from the National Ploughing Association is on the line. Good morning to you.
Morning, Claire.
So a big scale back this year.
Well, yes, Claire, like we're just going with the ploughing competitions. We hope we'll be able to have the ploughing competitions, but the trade event is what is being cancelled, and really that's the massive attraction for the general public, and obviously a huge event for the 1,700 companies that exhibit at the ploughing.
So what will happen then this year? What will it look like?
Well, I can't right now. I don't know, Claire, because I'm absolutely I'm no information on what it can look like. Mm-hmm. So that really will have to unfold as the time goes on. Hopefully we can have some people, but you know, we wouldn't be expecting that we would have that many, maybe a couple of thousand. But you know, the ploughing, the exhibition usually attracts in the region of 300,000 people over the 3 days. So obviously it would be a huge trade event and an economic impact in the region of 50 million. So we're not looking at anything in that scale whatsoever. We're just talking about ploughing match.
So look, obviously this was a really tough decision for you to have to arrive at.
Massive, absolutely massive, Claire. And we've had, you know, so many months of trying to decide, and you know, just swings and roundabouts all the time of where we're at, what can we do. And you know, I have to just, unfortunately, I have to say the lack of information really has brought us to this point, because there's no roadmap whatsoever for later in the summer or early autumn, and that's where we're at. We couldn't go ahead without knowing what might happen or could happen.
Okay,
and so we couldn't say to exhibitors that all we could say to them was we didn't know.
Yeah, because the hope would have been that people would be vaccinated at a level that would have allowed you to go ahead in some way, shape or form, but you felt you weren't getting clarity on that.
Well, we didn't even feel it. We just weren't clear. We were getting silence. So, you know, the first communication I got from government was, I had two phone calls from the Minister for Agriculture this week. And that's following. We're contacting the government since February of this year.
So what did Charlie McConnell Logue say to you?
Nothing, really. Just told me that he spoke to the minister, spoke to the Taoiseach, and spoke to the chief medical officer, and that hopefully in a number of weeks' time that there will be some level of further clarification, but still no commitment to what it would be later on. For the autumn. But even at that, Claire, to be honest with you, you know, I got that information this morning. And you know,
which information did you get this morning?
Oh, that about that. Hopefully there'll be some more information available within a number of weeks.
Okay.
But that's the first, you know, that's, we before that we've received nothing. And we've tried, we've asked, can we speak to people? Can we find out? Can we just try and make some kind of a stab at what we could do? And just nothing was available. Nobody was available to talk to us or tell us anything. Now, I'm saying that, Claire, and I'm saying on the same line, look, the health and safety risk, you know, trying to balance that with having an event, you know, you have to keep that in mind all the time. But we didn't even get the chance to try and see what the event could look like.
Mm-hmm. So there was no advice then coming from the minister?
Well, not just the minister, nobody. Taoiseach Tánaiste, as you know, Minister Catherine Martin said a couple of weeks ago that we weren't under her remit, and when we tried to get, you know, to get on the panel that she had a task force set up, and we weren't eligible to be on that. So we really just were starved of information, I suppose.
So you made the call then, you decided to pull the main event, or the one that will attract all the crowds. You'll have a much, much smaller event happening this year, and then you look ahead to 2022.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We'd have to say that, you know, we hope with confidence that we can go ahead in 22. We're very fortunate that our landowners in Laois will welcome us back to the same venue. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're looking. But sure, today really, I suppose, today is about, you know, it's about the businesses. It really is about those businesses that have lost another opportunity to try and get back to business.
You sound frustrated and fed up.
Well, I suppose I would be frustrated, Claire, for everybody else in the business. You know what I mean? The ploughing is not about the NPA getting out there and having an event and making money. You know, because we're a national voluntary organisation, and we haven't even broken even for the event for a number of years. We're about promoting rural Ireland. And I do feel today that rural Ireland were left on the back bench. I really do. I think, you know, any information that I've got in the last number of weeks have been from event contractors, event promoters, because they're the people that we're being talked to. Mm-hmm. Rural Ireland wasn't being talked to, and other events this week were cancelled in rural Ireland because of lack of information. And I'm not saying that we wanted to bulldoze ahead, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Health and safety would always be our priority.
Anna Marie McHugh from the National Ploughing Association on Today with Claire Byrne. And Valerie also spoke to Jo Duffy about her menopause on the Lifeline.
You described your menopause to other people as having a breakdown.
That's right. Now, I had an underlying condition, Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid, underactive thyroid condition. So I thought this was being caused by that, even though I'd been on the thyroid medication for years. I thought, well, why would it suddenly change? Now, things happened in my life. My son, about a year before, was diagnosed with a serious illness. But yet I knew in myself that wasn't causing this. The main thing that started to happen first was that I couldn't fall asleep.
Okay.
Now, when I say I couldn't fall asleep at all.
Yeah.
And I mean, that will drive anybody crazy, right? So I was gone to my doctor. Now, she did say at some point you might be menopausal, but because I didn't know anything about menopause, I think I was like 46 at the time, I thought, no, don't be ridiculous. That's not true. Then she said, oh, you're depressed because of your son. And I'm like, no, I don't think it's that. So she did offer me, I think some of the women have been talking about it, Femiston or something. Yeah. Anyway, it just didn't suit me. Within about two or three weeks, I just felt like my body wasn't mine. You have a period all the time. Mm. So that was horrible. So I came off that. My sleep wasn't improving. I was on antidepressants. I was given sleeping tablets. I was going to an acupuncturist nearly every day just to get me through the day, who was putting he's great at what he does. He was putting needles into my head and connecting it up to an electrical current to try and stimulate, you know, the front parts of my brain. Mm. He told me that I was one of the worst cases of depression he'd ever seen. But, you know, I was still at home with my two sons trying to keep my stuff together. But then basically one night, I think I had taken 2, 3, maybe going into sleeping tablet number 4. Mm-hmm. And then I just started having something like a seizure. And my youngest son had to call an ambulance for me, my 18-year-old. Yeah. And I was sitting in the ambulance. I was so happy because I thought finally someone is listening to me. But I was put in a room on my own in the regional. And the man came to talk to me and so-called analyzed me and just told me I was too hard on myself and gave me emergency kind of sedative medication, which you'd just be like a vegetable on it. And, you know, I suppose little by little it kept going. And I'm very into alternative therapies and healthy eating, and everybody who knew me was so surprised to hear, like, God, Val, you know, this isn't you. Yeah. And it was like I was just a completely different person. So I have never heard the words bioidentical hormones from my GP. And I was on the patches for a little while, and then in COVID, in last year, there was a shortage of them. You couldn't get them, so I came off it because there wasn't anything. So, and coincidentally, I had just been at my GP last week, and I was asking her about testosterone because, of course, women need that too. Mm. And, you know, I was met, and she's a lady doctor, and I was met with her. I know. And I'm like, you know, it's just not good enough.
Mm-hmm. And when was when was the word menopause first mentioned?
A very nice Indian doctor, she said it to me, you're menopausal. I went to her as one of, you know, she did these vitamin C infusions. Look, I was doing anything. I would have eaten shoe leather if you told me it was going to make me feel better.
Yeah.
And then Izumi called Jo with her story.
To be honest, I didn't know I was in perimenopause because nobody told me. But I would say I was about 45, 46.
Okay.
A bit like a previous caller, I wasn't feeling well. I was working in an international company, managing big team, working alongside with the males. You know, very stressful, you know, very challenging every day. And then I have 4 children, so I struggle through, you know, running the home and going to work. And then gradually I noticed I'm not myself. And I went to my GP, and the GP gave me a vitamin B injection to see if that would help me, but that didn't. And then about a year, maybe 2 years or so, I tried different kinds of antidepressant, and then it got worse and worse. And couldn't sleep during the night. I have a nearly panic attack during the night. So went back to the GP. Then GP gave me tranquilizers and sleeping pills. Then I became hugely dependent on them. I couldn't even, you know, sleep without them. I couldn't talk to anybody without them. I was very withdrawn. And the relationship with my husband was terrible. Everything he did, I didn't like it. And he felt helpless. And then suicidal thought just creeped in. Every time I drive, I was looking at the wall, thinking to crashing. Driving around the bypass motorway, thinking to fly off the bridge. And then eventually I started to pile up the medication. I lied to everybody. I lost them and then piled them up. Go to pharmacy, get extra one.
Yeah.
they've stocked up God knows how many sleeping pills and tranquilizers. And then one day, one night, I woke up during the night. That's all I remember. I took as many as I can that night. Thank God my husband noticed something isn't all right with me. He rang the ambulance. I have no recollection whatsoever. A few days later, I woke up in the St. Patrick's Mental Hospital. I was there for 3 months, private care. I think it was costing around €7,000 per week for me to stay there. Nobody mentioned to me about perimenopause.
And then psychologist Stephanie Regan on the effects of the menopause.
Extraordinary, I have to say, my own person, just a personal reaction, is I've been listening throughout the week, and I've always been very aware, being a mature woman myself and having gone through the menopause, just at that level, that the beginning, especially the perimenopause, it is such a lonely, lonely journey. And people don't know what's wrong with them. I didn't know what was wrong with me either. And this program has just really opened this up to such, so that people can speak, get the answers, find out, not be confused, not be on your own, not wake up at night and feel you're going mad. This, it's emotional listening to it. Fabulous, just fabulous.
And would you be conscious in your professional role, Stephanie, when people come in to see you, would you be conscious of the menopause? And
it's hugely so. Okay. Now, I think, and that's informed very much, A, by my training, but obviously more by also my personal experience. You know, I was very aware that you would go to the doctor, and, you know, the doctors would have said even to me, you know, take whatever you think works, you know, and I thought, well, that's not, you know, I'm not the doctor. I don't know what works. So I've really carried that understanding and that confusion into my own understanding of what's going on. So when people come, you know, into therapy and come for help and support with things, often anxiety is part of it. You know, it might be anxiety, sleeplessness, things like that. So there's obviously a mix of symptoms that can, so it can be mixed in with other things, very like one or two of your ladies there were explaining. You know, you can be sleepless, you can be anxious, and there may be a mix. I think it was Valerie who mentioned there earlier that there'd been some issue over her son, for example, in the previous year. So there was a kind of feeling of, oh, so somebody might relate that to that. But, I mean, the whole thing about a clinical picture is that it is your job to try and discern what is, you know, what do these symptoms relate to? Do they overlap with other issues, or do they not? So I would always factor in for really any woman from sort of 43, even, you know, less, 40, 50s, I'd always think along those lines. I'd always have that within the grid of what I'm listening to. And especially, like, right at the moment, I'm with a lovely woman, and it's undoubtedly menopause, and I actually referred her back to your program to listen. I said, you must listen because you'll hear it. And, you know, she'd gone back to her doctor. I'd asked her to go back, and the doctor had given her blood test and said, no, you're not in it. I said, sorry, that's wrong. You know, that is wrong. You need to go back again. Listen into the program. Listen into Dr. Lundy. It's not always showing up. This is perimenopause. That's where you are. So that's the confusion that's out there for people. And doctors don't pick it up all the time, and they offer the antidepressants, but it's not necessarily the right thing. And certainly I do a lot of that in my work, and I would support women to get the right answers, and not for me to start ascribing it, if you like, to the wrong thing. And that's the problem.
And Dave also called Joe about the lack of information and help for his wife.
I texted your show just to thank you and on all your researchers and participants for, you know, addressing the elephant in the room, insofar as my poor wife has had an awful experience wherein she's just been fobbed off by medics in the past, but she now has the courage and conviction to go to a new GP and get this affliction, as he describes it, into some sort of context, and try and return to a normal way of life, if you will.
And when you say fobbed off, Dave, what does that mean?
She was told that essentially she was too young, that she didn't display the proper symptoms, and to sort of go away with herself, you know.
And you're telling me she was, what, around
46 to 48 at that time,
And she was told she was too young to have the menopause?
Yeah.
Even though she had symptoms?
Yes.
Okay, and what do you say? She's now going to change GP. Is that easy?
Yeah. It's a bit difficult just now.
Yeah, of course.
The COVID situation, you understand. But she does have. She's actually going to go to a GP that I attend myself.
Okay.
And she has the confidence to do it now.
Yeah, she wants all the options on the table.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
But I don't think that would have happened, Joe, if she hadn't heard what you know.
The other women.
No.
Yeah. Okay, and
so
you
she's
also
got that. It's given her that sort of, you know, steel to go and do.
Yeah, and as you see, you begin your text there saying we're empty nesters, and that was a point made so strongly yesterday by number one about loss. You come to a stage in your life where 50 children might be gone. Your period's finished, you feel there's a new life ahead with you and your partner or whatever.
Yeah.
You maybe because the children are gone, you might have a few more bob available, and then suddenly you're hit with the menopause.
Yeah. And it's not a pleasant experience, Joe. Let me tell you, it's very, very uncomfortable for.
And Joe was talking to Lynn.
In your contact, you say, Lynn, my youngest daughter is 6. She has never known me not menopausal. She has never experienced me at my best.
Yeah, that's right.
And what?
I had a surgical menopause at 31, and my youngest baby was born 6 months before that.
Okay.
So, so she, I said that to Lisa earlier. It's like she's never seen me at my best.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now, thankfully, because it was a surgical menopause, it was preventative surgery.
Yeah.
I knew I was going to hit menopause the next day. I knew it was coming. So I was able to prepare. And I was spoken to afterwards about, shortly afterwards, nearly straight away, about HRT.
Okay.
And I was put straight on HRT.
Yeah.
So it was a synthetic form of HRT, the tablet form, that has come up all the week and a half on the show.
Yeah.
And it's true, over the 6 years, I've been on different forms of that synthetic HRT when they stopped working. And it's only recently, within the last 6 months, that I've heard and understood about body identical HRT.
Okay.
And had met with a consultant. My GP referred me to a consultant to speak to, because she didn't know. She wasn't versed on all this. So I went, and it was Deirdre Lundy who was my consultant. Absolute wonder woman. I think half of the or most of the Irish women now have a girl crush here on Deirdre Lundy. She's super.
Okay. She's brilliant.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
And how are you now, Lynn?
I'm good. I started on the body identical HRT in March, and it's going okay. It's like, now obviously with your hormones changing, there's going to be an adjustment period and stuff. But yeah, no, I'm feeling really, really positive, which is good.
From the Live Line with Joe Duffy. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.